Welcome to Monday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We hope you had a great weekend. Thanks for being with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, The Future is Flag, a brand new film that takes us inside women's flag football, which, oh, by the way, will be an Olympic sport along with men's flag football in the Los Angeles Games coming up in 2028. But first, we'll preview tomorrow's State of the Union address. Welcome to this Monday's Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and President Trump delivers his State of the Union address that we can all hear live tomorrow night at 8 p.m. right here on Prairie Public. And the address comes at a moment of unusual political and constitutional tension. Just days ago, the United States Supreme Court struck down key tariffs in a ruling that reshaped executive authority and trade policy. And this week also marks the passing of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson, a figure who changed the trajectory of American political activism and presidential politics. To help us understand and connect these threads, the presidency, the courts, and the evolving role of protest in American life, we're joined by Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He is the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University, public historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Association, and senior historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Dr. Cullinane studies international relations, the presidency, and American culture, and examines how the past helps us better understand our future. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are on the eve now of a significant address to the country, and as we look ahead to President Trump's State of the Union address, historically, provide us context, if you would, Dr. Cullinane, on what the purpose of this address is and how it's evolved from a constitutional obligation into really a national political moment.
Yeah, it's really become a standard feature of American politics. Once a year, the president walks through the Congress, the chamber of the House of Representatives, and comes down into the main podium there to deliver this really all-important speech about the State of the Union. But that wasn't always the way it was in American history. And as so often is the case, I find myself, reminding people that the State of the Union was always important in some ways, but it wasn't the media spectacle that it is now. So back in the day, from George Washington all the way up to William Howard Taft, the presidents delivered a written message to Congress that was often read in the Congress. And presidents sometimes staged photographs of themselves reading in the cabinet room of the White House the message, as if they were reading it to Congress. But it wasn't until Woodrow Wilson's presidency that that a message was literally delivered in Congress, in the House of Representatives, to a live audience. And since Wilson's time, it's grown in pomp and circumstance. So we have, the Supreme Court justice who, theatrically barely move a muscle. And then meanwhile, you have, the standing ovations from Democrats or Republicans, depending on which party is in power. That sort of gradually came into focus in the late 20th century. There wasn't, a raucous cry when Wilson read out, the plans for the new nationalism, or when FDR was, making his famous Four Freedoms speech for one of his State of the Unions. I forget, it was in 1940 or 41.
41. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that wasn't a big raucous affair. This is a very modern thing. And what we've seen recently too is dissenters who are making a spectacle of themselves at these moments as well. All of it is about attention, right? Politics has become about, like so many things, has become about getting our eyeballs on the screen and watching something that's shocking. And so that wasn't always the case in American politics.
Current polls that I've seen, Dr. Cullinane, say that a majority of Americans believe the State of the Union is not strong as President Trump prepares for his address. Of course, he'll tell us, more likely than not, that it is strong. What should we read into how he tells us the state of our nation is?
Well, I guess you're going to read into it whatever your perspective is. And among all the listeners of your show, there are some that are going to say that the State of the Union is strong, and there's some that are going to say otherwise. And I think ultimately some of the big issues that Trump has sort of failed to capitalize on, groceries, the word groceries and affordability, those two words, if those are concerns of yours, you're going to think the State of the Union is not so strong. If you, however, are, in favor of immigration reform, you might think that it's either strong or not strong, right? I mean, if you're if you're protesting ICE raids in Minnesota, the State of the Union is really weak. But if you believe that, you know, immigration and the crackdown on immigrants in the United States is a good thing, then you might think it's strong. So I think it's all about perspective. But ultimately, if you're looking at the polling right now, and if you're Donald Trump, you should be worried. CNN released a poll this week that had his approval rating at 26%, which is an all-time low for him in both terms. So he's coming into the midterm elections and he's coming into the State of the Union really with a very low popularity rating, particularly among independents.
Given that the Supreme Court has struck down broad tariffs and the president now has announced a 15% global tariff that he'll immediately invoke, if I do the math, Congress is going to have to speak to this maybe in July, right in front of midterms. How tough will that be for Republicans to vote to continue President Trump's tariff policy?
Yeah, Craig, you're spot on with your dates. But let me roll back a little bit for listeners and just say, what's happened here is that the Supreme Court has announced that these tariffs are unconstitutional and that he can't use the laws that he has used to apply those tariffs. And so he's going to a different law, one that regards national security as the realm of the president's powers, and he's applying a blanket tariff. So what we've lost here is Trump's ability to level a higher tariff on one country over another based on emergency powers. That does change the geopolitical situation. I'll come back to that later. But to get to your point, what is left in this sort of situation is that he can levy those for 60 days, and Congress then needs to either decide if those are indeed the will of the Congress, or if they do nothing, those tariffs have to come off. So this leaves the entire world in a really weird economic situation where does Congress just not do anything and these tariffs come off, in which case you're not going to invest any money in building a factory in the United States right now. You'll just wait it out, right, and get to July and then see, you know, what Congress does. Or is this something that is going to galvanize some parts of the world to start shipping more to the United States, like China, right? China had huge tariffs placed on it. Now it's only got a 15% tariff. So China is the big winner in this, strangely enough.
And ironically, there's a meeting coming up in April.
That's right. So Donald Trump will be going to China to talk to Xi Jinping, the premier and general secretary of the Communist Party. And that is going to be an incredibly important meeting. Now, what's really interesting about that, too, is that he's not the only one going to China to talk to Xi. So you've got, I think this week, maybe even today, the Chancellor Merz of Germany is over in China talking about basically more trade between the EU and China. I mean, Europe is pivoting towards China. If we didn't want Europe to pivot towards China, maybe we shouldn't have put such high tariffs on the EU and said some of the things that we've said about the EU. But that's what's happening. And that is historically what has happened when the United States has neglected its partners in Europe. So in the 70s, this happened when detente was going on, the Europeans moved towards the Soviet Union. And I think it's very similar to what we have going on now with Europe looking to China for electric vehicles, for solar panels, for manufactured goods that would have normally come from the United States or elsewhere in the world.
So we've talked about maybe some economic points that he'll talk about. We've talked about trade policy a little bit. You mentioned immigration and border enforcement. We're at a time when DHS funding is now frozen, essentially, and is shut down. What do you think the president will say about immigration and his immigration policies, keeping in mind that, again, many Americans now are trending away from whether he's doing a good job?
Well, he's going to say it's working. I think you see, Donald Trump is never going to say that there are mistakes that are made. Roy Cohn taught him that a long time ago in New York. You know, never, never, ever admit that you're wrong. And that's something that he's modeled himself on. But the American people are unhappy with the two deaths of U.S. citizens that happened in Minnesota. And they're also not pleased with the tactics of ICE agents. And so that there's been major backlash in Congress. But also more generally, there's been a swing in public opinion around that. Does that mean that that public opinion has swung, in favor of immigration? I don't think that's true either. I think that the American public are still opposed to, mass migration to the United States. However, what does this mean for Trump when it comes to what he says to, you know, tomorrow night? And I think he's going to say that ICE agents are doing what they have to do to see his mandate through. But I think the fine print of all that is really where the public is going to decide during the midterm elections if that is what they want.
Lost in all of the discussion recently is what the first shutdown was all about just a few months ago, and that's healthcare. Mm-hmm. It seems like the discussion about healthcare has fallen off the radar. Do you expect the president to talk about that tomorrow night?
Well, it's funny. It's fallen off the radar for so many people because the healthcare situation where the subsidies were dropped, that only affected 15 million people. Now, I say only a little bit tongue in cheek here, but it affected people in certain states and at a certain income level. And 15 million people is not a lot. It's probably not even enough to swing an election nowadays. But in any case, this is where perspective matters. If you're one of those 15 million people, it's gonna be the top of your list of priorities. And if it's not affecting you, you probably haven't given it a second thought. The Democrats have really failed to have a nationwide issue take hold, right? So they've tried with the healthcare thing, but as I said, it didn't affect enough people. And they are also, the immigration side of things, they've not really adopted immigration reform as a plank. They've just decried the violence that's been going on in Minnesota and in other states like Chicago or say Portland, right? But they haven't made a national issue. Whereas Trump, that's all he's done. He's managed to speak to the nation as a whole. The Democrats are going to be successful in November. They have to have a national message that reaches the majority of Americans.
Joining my conversation with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He's the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University, public historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Association, and senior historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Dr. Cullinane, what do you anticipate President Trump's legislative priorities are going to be if he talks about them and prioritizes them tomorrow in the State of the Union address?
I think it'll be reflective, first of all. I don't know how forward-looking he'll be. I think the Big Beautiful Bill is his major legislative accomplishment in this first year, and I think he's going to talk about that. It happens to be tax season as well, so people are getting their 1099s, and they're looking at how much they're going to get back. Again, this is where perspective comes in. If you're getting a tax rebate, you might be feeling pretty good. If suddenly you're paying more, which is unlikely to be the case for most Americans, then you might not be feeling as positive. But he'll be reflective. The One Beautiful Bill will be really important. He is going to almost certainly talk about tariffs, and this is where it might get uncomfortable for the justices who are sitting in front of him. And then
right in front of him,
and they're not supposed to budge a muscle, right? But I think they'll, John Roberts has said before that he found it quite hard to be in the State of the Union situations because they are not allowed to, say anything partisan or be partisan. Anyway, the looking forward, what's going to be on the docket, it's hard to say. I think they're looking at 2026. The administration is looking at 2026 with either worry about the coming blue wave or the hope that Republicans will hold on to at least the Senate and then they can push through judicial nominations, which will be a priority for the second year.
Before we move off the State of the Union address, will he make changes to voter ID a top legislative priority like we've heard about in the recent weeks that may even change how the filibuster is applied just for this single issue?
It's hard to say. Yeah, that's the SAVE Act, which would require ID. It's also hard to say because that will be coming in a year when Republicans are starting to drop away from that solid block that they were. So the razor thin majority that they have in the House of Representatives means they only need three Republicans to fall away. And the Democrats, if they keep strong as a block, then they can block any legislation. So it's hard to say if he's going to push for a congressional maneuver, which would be a joint resolution between the two houses in order to pass the SAVE Act, because it does open up the door for the end of the filibuster. Now, Trump has said that the filibuster should go. And he didn't say just for the SAVE Act. He didn't just say for Supreme Court nominations. This was for everything. So, people on both sides of the aisle have talked about the filibuster as being anti-democratic, but they've also said that it does help to slow down radical legislation. And it's unclear whether the centrists in either side of the party want to get rid of it.
many Republicans are fearful of what goes around comes around, if that were to be the case for sure. Before we leave the subject, in our history, has a State of the Union address radically changed America's momentum, historically really shaped then public opinion moving forward, or really ignited policy outcomes in a way that probably wouldn't have happened were it not for this address?
So I think the answer to that is pretty simple. I think it's a no. Despite the fact that there's all this pomp and circumstance, and there's often dissenters who get the headlines, and actually in the last 20 years, there's been this dissenting message from the opposite party that's often been televised after the State of the Union address. All of that hasn't really moved the dial. The news cycle moves so fast nowadays that even if Donald Trump was to come up and have the most moving speech, chances are whatever happens tomorrow is going to steal the headlines. And so it's funny, I think we're probably in store for a revolution in how the State of the Union is done, because it's not really done well anymore. You know, that sort of the model that we have right now was great when network media aired. So they were talking about the 70s, 80s, and 90s, maybe 2000s, early 2000s, where network media would air a State of the Union and the country would watch. Nowadays, people watch everything on demand. If they're going to watch the State of the Union, they might do it on YouTube, or they might just do the sound bites that are clipped together by their favorite influencers. So it's a very different setup now, and it'll be interesting to see how it changes. I think it's probably due for some sort of change because of how media has changed.
I want to move on to the legacy of Jesse Jackson. Of course, he passed away last week, and his passing really, in my eyes, marks an end of the era of American political activism in many regards. How would you characterize his place in the broader history of presidential politics?
Oh, well, Jesse Jackson was so important he really solidified the Democratic Party, I think, behind African-American civil rights politics. So he ran, of course, in 84 and in 88. And 88 was a really serious contender for the Democratic nomination. Although I don't think a lot of people did take him seriously, because he was seen as being an activist, you know, a sort of, like a reverend, an evangelical political activist, yeah. A preacher of sorts, right? But he was, you know, what he was talking about, the Rainbow Coalition, what he was doing in terms of political activism, brought together a broad coalition of partners that was really important to African Americans. I mean, Bill Clinton is an outgrowth of Jesse Jackson's politics in a lot of ways. He understands African American voters in the 1990s in a way that Jackson was articulating it in the 1980s. And Jackson's links all the way back to Martin Luther King in the 1960s and the March on Washington, King's assassination at, in Memphis. I mean, Jackson was there. I mean, he was a part of that movement. He had real chops as a civil rights activist. And so, yeah, I think also with John Lewis's passing a couple of years ago, we've seen a generation of activists who were instrumental in shaping the civil rights movement pass on. And that does mean that, you know, the nature of that movement changes as well.
Given the passing of John Lewis and Jesse Jackson, is there anyone today in your eyes that's now charged with, bears the responsibility of, is carrying the civil rights message forward?
Well, I think the movement, the civil rights movement has changed dramatically over the last few years. It's become far more democratic, far more multipolar, I would say. So you have groups that are historically there, like the NAACP, which are, I mean, they're lawyers still. So they've been there since the 1909, but they operate in a much smaller fashion. They're not that social activism that King and Jackson and other groups like CORE and SNCC were back in the 60s, 50s and 60s. So what's happened now is that things have fractured more and more, but you have pockets of a swell of importance, like Black Lives Matter. When that became a priority, it was about police brutality and the shooting of Michael Brown. The killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis sparked its own set of police brutality activism. But there are other pockets of economic activism, but it has splintered along the goals. There's not one group. Like, I think that's always been the case. CORE and SNCC always dealt with voter registrations and, you know, civil rights in terms of voting rights. And that led directly to the, you know, the Voting Rights Act. I think we have those groups around still working to those ends, but it is very splintered. And I don't know, is there that sort of national unifying force that someone like King or Jesse Jackson or even Al Sharpton, for that matter, can manage to pull together?
Dr. Cullinane, as a historian then, when you connect these three developments, the State of the Union address, a Supreme Court ruling on executive power, the legacy of a major activist, what does this moment tell us about the health and the direction of American democracy?
Yeah, it's a great question, Craig. It is also an impossible one to answer. As a historian, I'm really bad at looking into the future and saying this is what's going to happen. But I think what I can say is that looking back, when you've had these major upheavals in politics, whether it's in that social activism world or in the presidency, or just generally in terms of how voter sentiment is feeling, what you see is that, well, I think I mentioned this to you before about what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the model of America should be, or the symbol of America, and that's a pendulum. Whenever things swing in one direction, they tend to swing back. So I don't know what that's going to look like, but with executive power, for example, whenever in American history executive power has run away, Congress has found some way to rein it in, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully, but there's always an attempt. So I wouldn't be surprised to say that, you know, there may be some congressional pushback. I mean, we see the midterms coming. We can say that there's Republicans beginning to fall away from the Republican narrative. So there could be some pushback there. In terms of activism, you know, my hope is that we see others like Jesse Jackson and John Lewis spring and come to the fore and lead the country to a better place in African-American civil rights. So, yeah, change is afoot.
What perspective then would you encourage listeners to keep in mind during these politically intense moments when we are listening tomorrow night to that State of the Union address? Big picture, what perspective should we kind of think about?
Well, here's a big picture perspective that I'd like everyone to consider, and that is that we are not exceptional. The American democracy is an experiment. It has always been an experiment. We can screw this up. I mean, it's been going really well, I think, right? Like over, you know, we're celebrating 250 years of democracy in America. It's a great time to reflect on our accomplishments as a nation. But I think the notion that just because we've had 250 years of success doesn't mean that the next 250 are going to look exactly the same. That success relies on us. We are the wellspring of democracy. Each and every one of us that can vote and that can develop the ideas for the nation state, we are the most important agents of the future. And we have to own that. That's a real big responsibility. So in terms of perspective, I think people need to look in and channel what they think they can do. Like John F. Kennedy said in his inaugural, you know, ask not what you know your country can do for you, but let's take action. Let's see what we can do for our country.
And before I let you go, I must ask, what's the new news with the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library?
Well, the new news is that we're only 4 months away from opening, which is really exciting. Five months. July 4th is obviously the opening. In April, in a couple of months, I believe there are a number of updates about the week of opening events that are going to be on. And I think that's just about enough time because people are already so excited that they want to hear more about that opening week of events. Obviously, the president will be coming to Medora, which is a huge deal. But also, just to put this on everyone's radar, in October, the 9th to the 11th, there will be a major convention, the first ever Theodore Roosevelt convention. It'll be hosted at the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. It'll be put on by the Theodore Roosevelt Association and the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University. And that is going to be the other big event of the year out at Medora. So keep your eyes open for that. It's already been advertised. Tickets, I think, are nearly, well, I think a third of the tickets have already been sold, and I think we're just announcing the speakers this week.
Congratulations on your work, certainly, and to all of the folks involved with the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. That's Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University, public historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Association, and the senior historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. As always, Dr. Cullinane, thank you for helping us connect the present to the deeper currents of American history. And always, it's a pleasure to have you on Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, a new film. The future is flag. That's flag football. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Flag football is headed to the Olympics in 2028 for both men and women. And for the women at the center of the game, that moment has been years in the making. Today, we're joined by filmmaker Monica Medellin, whose new documentary, The Future is Flag, captures the rise of women's flag football at a pivotal turning point. Produced by Under Armour's Lab 96 Studios and SMAC Entertainment, the film follows two elite athletes, one from the United States, one from Mexico, as they compete on the global stage while preparing for the sport's Olympic debut at the LA Games in 2028. Known for her athlete-first storytelling in projects like Surf Girls and Making History, the women of, of Free Ride, Medellin brings an intimate lens to the sport and a movement gaining global momentum. Monica, I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for joining us here on Main Street.
Thank you. Me too. This is such an exciting day for women's sports and filmmaking.
For this project, Monica, what drew you to flag football as a subject, and why did this feel right for you right now?
So when I got the news that flag football was going to be featured for the first time in the 2028 Olympics here in Los Angeles, I just knew that this was the opportunity to make a film following the women behind it. Who are the pioneers who have been paving the way to get to this point? Because most people in everyday life think that flag football is still a recreational sport. So I just love this film because it really puts that on its head and, you know, helps people realize that this is a real sport and there's real stakes and these are the women who are leading it.
I think the title of your film, The Future is Flag, is somewhat bold and declarative. What does that phrase mean to you?
The phrase reminds me of the moment we are in time right now. The NFL is starting a pro flag football league. They've committed $32 million into this league. The NCAA is now in talks about sanctioning girls flag football across the country. And there are over 500,000 youth participants in flag football. So that's what we mean when we say the future is flag. This is such an important part of the puzzle, though, because athlete storytelling is my way of helping people get to know these athletes beyond the game, beyond the competition. Who are they as people? Who are they as humans? And how can we start to root for them and get to know them so when the time comes to play in the Olympics, we feel this connection?
Monica, how significant is it, the sport being included in the LA 28 Olympic Games, not just for the athletes, and maybe not even just for football, but for the broader landscape of women's sports?
This isn't just about flag football. This is about women's sports exploding in popularity and visibility. Ashley Clam and Diana Flores, our two main characters in the film, are not just pushing their sport of flag football. They're pushing women's sports to the global stage. And funny enough, the movement of flag football has actually been on the shoulders of women. So that's why this film is so special, because it's not just about the sport itself. It's about setting the new standard and precedent that women's sports is here to stay. This isn't just a moment, it's really a movement.
When you were filming the doc, did you feel you were at a turning point in sports history? I'll be honest with you, Monica, it seems like it might be to me. Women competing in many other sports is highly interesting. I'm a huge fan, but football is a little different in my eyes, and bringing that to the world stage, it's something. Did you feel that?
This question makes me emotional because it reminds me of being on set with the two women of The Future is Flag and finding out that the NFL was investing $32 million into a pro flag football league. That investment isn't just money. It's creating a pathway for young girls to be able to dream that they too can become Olympic athletes one day. So it brings me back to when we were all on set together in Mexico, filming the final scene of the film. And in that moment, we realized all together that we're working towards something that really has legs and really has a future. So this project is really special because we were definitely ahead of the curve, you know. So taking the risk and investing in women's flag football at this stage has been one of the most special opportunities in my filmmaking career.
So you mentioned Diana Flores and Ashley Clam, two competitors at the top of the global rankings in this sport. What makes them compelling protagonists in your film?
I love these women as humans, not only athletes. Not only are they, you know, the greatest athletes in their sport, Diana Flores is the team captain and quarterback of Team Mexico, and Ashley is the wide receiver of Team USA. They both have multiple medals, including two golds. They're so legitimate, but what makes them great is actually who they are in their heart as people and as humans. And that's what we try to unlock in the future is flag. As a former athlete myself, I feel a really deep connection with the women athletes that I work with on set because we have that shared experience of what sports can do for your confidence, what sports can do for your life. And these women are the walking, breathing examples of what sports open the doors for in the future. So I just love them so much.
I sense their rivalry is intense, but also maybe respectful. Can you give us insight into their relationship as people?
Rivalries are what make sports great. So we definitely don't shy away from the competitiveness and the elite athleticism that's required in flag football. These athletes are at the top of their game and they should be treated like elite athletes. The thing that's different is in women's sports, we all have to come together because we have a greater purpose. On the field, they're each other's biggest rivals. But off the field, there's a mutual understanding that we all need to come together and grow this sport because none of us can do it alone.
Enjoying my conversation with Monica Medellin. Her new documentary is The Future is Flag, and it's all about women's flag football. Tell me about the sport. What surprised you, Monica, about the sport? We've all seen it 1,000 times in tackle football, right? But few of us, I'll argue, have ever seen a women's flag football game. What surprised you the most?
The fandom. I would say the fandom in flag football is insane to witness in person. I would say, you know, even though it is a very competitive sport, there's a lot of fun. So if someone gets a touchdown, they are having a celebration dance that is coordinated with every single person on their team. Like, there's just this element of levity and fun that I think flag football brings to the table that maybe other sports, you know, don't have. So it's really exciting to watch the games and see how animated all of the athletes are and how excited they are to be a part of this game.
Monica, for you making this film, you have to develop respect from the athletes. How did you do that?
Building a relationship and building trust with athletes that I work with in my films is the number one priority because that's the way to have authenticity in front of the camera. If you have authentic relationships behind the camera, that's going to show on screen. So my filmmaking process, a lot of the time is dedicated to building real personal relationships with the women that I'm working with. So hopefully when you watch The Future is Flag, you can get a real insight on who this person is and not have the media trained version, not have the version that you can find anywhere on the internet. Like, you really have a real inside look that nobody really gets to see.
Your work is described as athlete first storytelling. What's that?
Yeah, oftentimes when I'm asked about my films, you know, the first questions are about the sport. And I think that that's great because the sport is the entrance into the world. But I think of all of my films as athlete first. This is the story about an athlete, what makes them tick, who they are, where they come from, why should we care, why should we root for them? So that's what athlete first means to me, and that's what all of my films are. The sport is amazing, but that's just the icing on the cake.
My wife will tell you that I can't get it in my head, the difference between cross-country skiing and downhill skiing. Back in the day, I skied a lot. downhill skiing. She likes to cross country ski. To me, it's skiing, but it is couldn't be any different, right? If I watch a women's flag football game, am I going to think the same thing? This is different than anything I've ever seen, or is this kind of like the men's sport that I'm used to?
Yeah, so I've learned a lot about the sport of flag football, making a flag football documentary. I mean, the first women's flag football documentary. And the traditional tackle football is a completely different sport than flag football. And you see it on both the women's side and the men's side. It just requires a different technical skill, a different discipline. It's a completely different game. They do coexist together. And I think that there's a very unique link between the two, because as you have maybe heard, there might be NFL players that play flag football in the Olympics in 2028. So I'm really interested to see if they can stand a chance in the flag football world, because it's going to kind of test them to have, you know, maybe a new set of skills up their sleeve.
Tell me about the partnership you carved with Under Armour's Lab 96 Studios and Smack Entertainment. How did that come together for you? And did they allow you to do the creativity that maybe some people might feel throttled when they make partnerships like this?
The key to my partnership with Under Armour's Lab 96 and Smack Entertainment is that they're really setting the standard as two companies that are truly investing in this sport ahead of everybody else. I can't do my job if there isn't proper funding, if there isn't proper marketing, if there isn't proper access to these athletes. So we really made a dream team, because all of us came together to combine our creativity and all of the logistics that go into making a film of this caliber that feels premium. And what you get is the future is flag. So I'm really excited to announce my partnership with these two companies and hope to continue our relationship in the future. As a female filmmaker, especially in sports, it's really important to have companies back you in your creativity.
High school women's sports here is a big deal. College women's sports here is a big deal. Certainly it's basketball. Certainly it's volleyball. Certainly it's hockey. And there's high school wrestling. But for someone who is watching this, maybe they've never thought about football before, for a young woman in their family, or if I'm a young person watching the film, what do you want them to think when they see your film?
I want any parent who's watching our film to know that their daughter can go play flag football and represent their country. They can go play flag football and get a college scholarship. They can play this sport and make a living off of it. And that's something that has never been a reality in the past. So these two women are two women that your daughters can be in the future. And that's the biggest message that I want to push with this project.
Am I going to see excitement?
Oh, totally. This game is the embodiment of excitement. And to set the record straight,
what's different about the women's game than maybe the men's game? Yeah, set me straight.
To set the record straight, there are amazing women's tackle football teams, and there is a league. So we're going to be seeing women on both sides, on the flag football side and the tackle football side. So I'm really excited to see what happens in the future. And I hope that flag football can really push for, you know, women on the tackle side to have an opportunity and a moment to be on a platform of this scale.
Is there a difference in the two games for men and women in the flag football side? Am I going to watch more passing on one side, more running on the other side? Is it just a different game, or is it played
the same?
What's on your plate? You make movies about athletes. What's next?
I'm really excited to keep promoting The Future is Flag. A film is nothing without promotion, without marketing, without people watching it. So if you're listening now, the best thing you can do for women's sports right now is go watch The Future is Flag. As far as what's upcoming, you can watch The Future is Flag on Prime Video right now. And the film just came out last Thursday.
Have you gotten any reviews?
No, not yet. Yeah, outside of promoting The Future is Flag, I'm in development for two really exciting women's sports documentaries in the women's soccer space and the women's basketball space. So you can look out for that and stay tuned.
What's your background in athletics? You said you used to be an athlete. Maybe you still are.
Yes, I've been playing sports my whole life. It started with sports like gymnastics, and then it went to more traditional team sports like volleyball. I also went on to run track and field in high school. And then I actually earned a collegiate D3 scholarship to play volleyball. I turned it down to go to D1 University of Oregon because I actually really wanted to be at a football school and have that traditional college experience. So now that I've made the first women's flag football documentary in the space, it makes a lot of sense. I've always loved football and I chose my college based on that.
Monica, while I have you here, one thing that I think is concerning to many that we've had discussions about here on this show is the fact that young women and young men, boys and girls as they're growing up, are specializing and putting all of their eggs in one sports basket when they're like in seventh grade. What are your thoughts about that?
I've talked to Ashley Clam, who's in the film, about this exact topic. Ashley played volleyball. She ran track. She did all of these different sports all the way through high school. It wasn't until high school, she was 16 years old, when she sat her parents down and said, I want to go all in on flag football. So I think that being a multi-sport athlete is very beneficial if you want to go to the pro or collegiate level. It just depends on, you know, the choice of the family and the child. So I am supportive of any path that any family wants to take in that realm.
Monica Medellin, she's the director of The Future is Flag, a brand new documentary that is available right now on Prime, produced by Under Armour's Lab 96 Studios and Smack Entertainment. It chronicles the rise of women's flag football and its historic path to the upcoming LA 28 Olympic Games. It's a powerful portrait of elite athletes, fierce international rivalry, and a sport that's stepping into the global spotlight, and Monica is bringing it to us. Thank you for the conversation, Monica, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Fargo Moorhead Opera presents a tribute to three tenors at the Fargo Theater, Saturday, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. The concert includes arias and ensemble pieces by Luciano Pavarotti, Placido Domingo, and Jose Carreras. Details at fmopera.org. Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
I recently read that the sales of long-stemmed roses for Valentine's Day were likely somewhere north of $200 million. Although those roses are not North Dakota natives, roses in the rose family are prominent components of the state's flora. The rose family is among the most economically important plant families. It includes almonds, apples, cherries, peaches, pears, plums, strawberries, raspberries, and of course, roses. Plants in the family may be characterized by having alternate and usually compound leaves and flowers with 5 petals and 5 sepals, several stamens, and one or more pistils. There are around 40 or so species in the rose family that are native to North Dakota. Some of the more common species include cinquefoil, hawthorn, juneberry, prairie smoke, also known as old man's whiskers or three-flowered avens, plum, choke cherry, raspberry, and strawberry. North Dakota designated wild prairie rose as a state flower back in 1907. It's interesting to note that the honor was bestowed not on one species, but 2 species of rose that are widely distributed in the state, the wild rose, also known as the prairie rose, and what is commonly known as smooth rose. And of course, there's the town of Wild Rose in Williams County, which was named for the wild roses that dotted the surrounding prairie. 2 other rose species are native to the state, the prickly rose and Woods rose. Woods rose is associated with wooded areas, but it's not named after its habitat. It's named for British botanist John Woods. In addition to adding color and texture to the landscape, roses also have considerable human utility. The Lakota use some species, particularly prairie rose and woods rose petals and roots, to make tea. The rose hips were used as food, for example, in stews and soups. Jams and jellies were made from petals. Some of you may remember Ewell Gibbons. He was a celebrity of sorts in the 1970s as a forager and author. His book, Stalking the Healthful Herbs, has a whole chapter dedicated to roses, how to eat a rose. I'm partial to rose hip tea. Simply steep a handful of fresh, clean rose hips in boiling water to cover and steep for a few minutes. Pour the tea into a coffee cup, add a cinnamon stick, then sit back and enjoy. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. It's coming up right after the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street. And at 8 p.m. Central tonight on Prairie Public, it's The Human Brain, as the child Scott Barry Kaufman took a test that changed his life. Tonight on Hidden Brain, hear how he challenges the labels that once held him back.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 23rd. The popular phrase, "happiness is a warm puppy," was coined in the Peanuts comic strip by Charles Schulz, who once said, "What is more happy than a little kid putting his arms around a warm puppy? If that isn't happiness, I don't know what is." North Dakota winters, with their short daylight hours, severe weather, holidays, school closings, travel challenges, and isolation, can become a source of distress for many people. Early darkness can worsen mood and anxiety problems. Financial stress, family tension, and substance misuse around the holidays can increase domestic violence. The State Highway Patrol says it tends to respond to more mental health-related calls during the winter months. On this date in 1973, a happy puppy tale warmed the heart of winter. The lucky puppy owners were interviewed by the Wahpeton Daily News for an authentic, believe-it-or-not, feel-good story. Mr. and Mrs. Broughton were returning to town from a trip and stopped at a rest area near Fargo. Each thought the other had put their puppy back in the car. Almost home, they realized the puppy was gone. Mrs. Broughton shed tears for days over the loss. Meanwhile, two college students, also returning to town, stopped at the same rest area to switch driving duties. There, they discovered a bewildered, shivering puppy. Because they lived in the Wahpeton College dorms, they brought the dog to another student's apartment, hoping to return it to its owners on their next trip. Mrs. Grenz, the friend's landlord, was a dog breeder and trainer. She offered to care for the tired, hungry puppy, which soon curled up, warm and content. In conversation with Postmaster McAloney, Mrs. Grenz mentioned the puppy's story, and he passed it along to his wife. Mrs. McAloney worked at the hospital, where she later struck up a conversation about dogs with Mrs. Broughton. When she learned about the lost puppy, Mrs. McAloney told her about Mrs. Grenz and her unexpected four-legged guest. Could it be the same puppy? Mrs. Broughton called Mrs. Grenz and described the missing dog in detail. It was a match. Overjoyed, Mrs. Broughton wanted to thank the anonymous young men who had rescued her puppy and visited it often at the Grenz home, but could not be contacted. Mrs. Grenz shook her head in amazement as she recalled the remarkable chain of coincidences that led her to the happy reunion. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Dakota Geriatrics presents Age-Friendly Healthcare for American Indian Elders, a virtual webinar for providers, healthcare professionals, and community workers working with American Indian populations. March 4th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Information at dakotageriatrics.org.
And that wraps up today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, as North Dakota's rural communities age and face persistent nursing shortages, the University of North Dakota is launching a new federally funded program that will help recruit students to fill the void. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.